and the tiny clicks of his blinking eyes. His fingers smell faintly of gasoline. His bladder is full. He feels on the bedside table for the glass containing his teeth. Dollarhide always puts in his teeth before he rises. Now he walks to the bathroom. He does not turn on the light. He finds the toilet in the dark and sits down on it like a good boy. Chapter 27. The change in grandmother first became apparent in the winter of 1947, when Frances was 8. She stopped taking meals in her room with Frances. They moved to the common table in the dining room, where she presided over meals with the elderly residents. Grandmother had been trained as a girl to be a charming hostess, and now she unpacked and polished her silver bell and put it beside her plate. Keeping a luncheon table going, pacing the service, managing conversation, batting easy conversational lobs to the strong points of the shy ones, turning the best facets of the bright ones in the light of the other guests' attention, is a considerable skill, and one now sadly in decline. Grandmother had been good at it in her time. Her efforts at this table did brighten meals initially for the two or three among the residents who were capable of linear conversation. Frances sat in the host's chair at the other end of the avenue of nodding heads as grandmother drew out the recollections of those who could remember. She expressed keen interest in Mrs. Floater's honeymoon trip to Kansas City, went through the yellow fever with Mr. Eaton a number of times, and listened brightly to the random, unintelligible sounds of the others. "Isn't that interesting, Frances?" she said, and rang the bell for the next course. The food was a variety of vegetable and meat mushes, but she divided it into courses, greatly inconveniencing the kitchen help. Mishaps at the table were never mentioned. A ring of the bell and a gesture in mid-sentence took care of those who had spilled or gone to sleep or forgotten why they were at the table. Grandmother always kept as large a staff as she could pay. As grandmother's general health declined, she lost weight and was able to wear dresses that had long been packed away. Some of them were elegant. In the cast of her features and her hairstyle, she bore a marked resemblance to George Washington on the dollar bill. Her manners had slipped somewhat by spring. She ruled the table and permitted no interruptions as she told of her girlhood in St. Charles, even revealing personal matters to inspire and edify Frances and the others. It was true that grandmother had enjoyed a season as a belle in 1907 and was invited to some of the better balls across the river in St. Louis. There was an object lesson in this for everyone, she said. She looked pointedly at Francis, who crossed his legs beneath the table. I came up at a time when little could be done medically to overcome the little accidents of nature, she said. I had lovely skin and hair, and I took full advantage of them. I overcame my teeth with force of personality and bright spirits, so successfully, in fact, that they became my beauty spot. I think you might even call them my charming trademark. I wouldn't have traded them for the world. She distrusted doctors, she explained at length. But when it became clear that gum problems would cost her her teeth, she sought out one of the most renowned dentists in the Midwest, Dr. Felix Bertel, a Swiss. Dr. Bertel's Swiss teeth were very popular with a certain class of people, grandmother said, and he had a remarkable practice. Opera singers, fearing that new shapes in their mouths would affect their tone, actors and others in public life, came from as far away as San Francisco to be fitted. Dr. Bertel could reproduce a patient's natural teeth exactly, and had experimented with various compounds and their effect on resonance. When Dr. Bertel had completed her dentures, her teeth appeared just as they had before, She overcame them with personality and lost none of her unique charm, she said with a spiky smile. If there was an object lesson in all this, Frances did not appreciate it until later. There would be no further surgery for him until he could pay for it himself. Frances could make it through dinner because there was something he looked forward to afterward. Queen Mother Bailey's husband came for her each evening in the mule-drawn wagon he used to haul firewood. If Grandmother was occupied upstairs, Frances could ride with them down the lane to the main road. He waited all day for the evening ride, sitting on the wagon seat beside Queen Mother, her tall, flat husband silent and almost invisible in the dark, the iron tires of the wagon loud in the gravel behind the jingle of the bits. Two mules, brown and sometimes muddy, their cropped manes standing up like brushes, swishing their tails across their rumps. The smell of sweat and boiled cotton cloth, snuff and warm harness. There was the smell of wood smoke when Mr. Bailey had been clearing new ground, and sometimes, when he took his shotgun to the new ground, a couple of rabbits or squirrels lay in the wagon box, stretched long as though they were running. They did not talk on the ride down the lane. Mr. Bailey spoke only to the mules. The wagon motion bumped the boy pleasantly against the Baileys. Dropped off at the end of the lane, he gave his nightly promise to walk straight back to the house and watched the lantern on the wagon move away. He could hear them talking down the road. Sometimes Queen Mother made her husband laugh, and she laughed with him. Standing in the dark, it was pleasant to hear them and know they were not laughing at him. Later, he would change his mind about that. Frances Dollarhide's occasional playmate was the daughter of a sharecropper who lived three fields away. Grandmother let her come to play because it amused her now and then to dress the child in the clothing Marion had worn when she was small. She was a red-haired, listless child, and she was too tired to play much of the time. One hot June afternoon, bored with fishing for doodlebugs in the chicken yard with straws, she asked to see Frances's private parts. In a corner between the chicken house and a low hedge that shielded them from the lower windows of the house, he showed her. She reciprocated by showing him her own, standing with her pilled cotton underwear around her ankles. As he squatted on his heels to see, a headless chicken flapped around the corner, traveling on its back, flapping up the dust. The hobbled girl hopped backward as it spattered blood on her feet and legs. Frances jumped to his feet, his trousers still down, as Queen Mother Bailey came around the corner after the chicken and saw them.
"Look here, boy," she said calmly. "You want to see what's what. Well, now you see. So go on and find yourself something else to do. Occupy yourself with children's doings and keep your clothes on. You and that child help me catch that rooster."
The children's embarrassment quickly passed as the rooster eluded them. But Grandmother was watching from the upstairs window. Grandmother watched Queen Mother come back inside. The children went into the chicken house. Grandmother waited 5 minutes, then came up on them silently. She flung open the door and found them gathering feathers for headdresses. She sent the girl home and led Frances into the house. She told him he was going back to Brother Buddy's orphanage after she had punished him. "Go upstairs, go to your room and take your trousers off and wait for me while I get my scissors." He waited for hours in his room, lying on the bed with his trousers off, clutching the bedspread and waiting for the scissors. He waited through the sounds of supper downstairs, and he heard the creak and clop of the firewood wagon and the snort of the mules as Queen Mother's husband came for her. Sometime toward morning he slept and woke in starts to wait. Grandmother never came. Perhaps she had forgotten. He waded through the routine of the days that followed, remembering many times a day in a rush of freezing dread. He would never cease from waiting. He avoided Queen Mother Bailey, would not speak to her, and wouldn't tell her why. He mistakenly believed that she had told Grandmother what she saw in the chicken yard. Now he was convinced that the laughter he heard while he watched the wagon lantern diminish down the road was about him. Clearly, he could trust no one. It was hard to lie still and go to sleep when it was there to think about. It was hard to lie still on such a bright night. Francis knew that Grandmother was right. He had hurt her so. He had shamed her. Everyone must know what he had done, even as far away as St. Charles. He was not angry at Grandmother. He knew that he loved her very much. He wanted to do right. He imagined that burglars were breaking in, and he protected Grandmother, and she took back what she said. "You're not a child of the devil, after all, Francis. You are my good boy." He thought about a burglar breaking in, coming in the house determined to show Grandmother his private parts. How would Francis protect her? He was too small to fight a big burglar. He thought about it. There was Queen Mother's hatchet in the pantry. She wiped it with newspaper after she killed a chicken. He should see about the hatchet. It was his responsibility. He would fight his fear of the dark. If he really loved Grandmother, he should be the thing to be afraid of in the dark, the thing for the burglar to be afraid of. He crept downstairs and found the hatchet hanging on its nail. It had a strange smell, like the smell at the sink when they were drawing a chicken. It was sharp, and its weight was reassuring in his hand. He carried the hatchet to Grandmother's room to be sure there were no burglars. Grandmother was asleep. It was very dark, but he knew exactly where she was. If there was a burglar, he would hear him breathing just as he could hear Grandmother breathing. He would know where his neck was just as surely as he knew where Grandmother's neck was. It was just below the breathing. If there was a burglar, he would come up on him quietly like this. He would raise the hatchet over his head with both hands like this. Francis stepped on Grandmother's slipper beside the bed. The hatchet swayed in the dizzy dark and pinged against the metal shade of her reading lamp. Grandmother rolled over and made a wet noise with her mouth. Francis stood still. His arms trembled from the effort of holding up the hatchet. Grandmother began to snore. The love Francis felt almost burst him. He crept out of the room. He was frantic to be ready to protect her. He must do something. He did not fear the dark house now, but it was choking him. He went out the back door and stood in the brilliant night, face upturned, gasping as though he could breathe the light. A tiny disk of moon, distorted on the whites of his rolled-back eyes, rounded as the eyes rolled down, and was centered at last in his pupils. The love swelled in him unbearably tight, and he could not gasp it out. He walked toward the chicken house, hurrying now, the ground cold under his feet, the hatchet bumping cold against his leg, running now before he burst. Francis, scrubbing himself at the chicken yard pump, had never felt such sweet and easy peace. He felt his way cautiously into it and found that the peace was endless and all around him. What Grandmother kindly had not cut off was still there, like a prize, when he washed the blood off his belly and legs. His mind was clear and calm. He should do something about the nightshirt. Better hide it under the sacks in the smokehouse. Discovery of the dead chicken puzzled Grandmother. She said it didn't look like a fox job. A month later, Queen Mother found another one when she went to gather eggs. This time, the head had been wrung off. Grandmother said at the dinner table that she was convinced it was done for spite by some sorry help I ran off. She said she had called the sheriff about it. Francis sat silent at his place, opening and closing his hand on the memory of an eye blinking against his palm. Sometimes in bed, he held himself to be sure he hadn't been cut. Sometimes when he held himself, he thought he felt a blink. Grandmother was changing rapidly. She was increasingly contentious and could not keep household help. Though she was short of housekeepers, it was the kitchen where she took personal charge, directing Queen Mother Bailey to the detriment of the food. Queen Mother, who had worked for the Dollar Hides all her life, was the only constant on the staff. Red-faced in the kitchen heat, Grandmother moved restlessly from one task to the next, often leaving dishes half-made, never to be served. She made casseroles of leftovers while vegetables wilted in the pantry. At the same time, she became fanatical about waste. She reduced the soap and bleach in the wash until the sheets were dingy gray. In the month of November, she hired 5 different black women to help in the house. They would not stay. Grandmother was furious the evening the last one left. She went through the house yelling. She came into the kitchen and saw that Queen Mother Bailey had left a teaspoonful of flour on the board after rolling out some dough. In the steam and heat of the kitchen, a half hour before dinner, she walked up to Queen Mother and slapped her face. Queen Mother dropped her ladle, shocked. Tears sprang into her eyes. Grandmother drew back her hand again. A big pink palm pushed her away.
"Don't you ever do that. You're not yourself, Mrs. Dollarhide, but don't you ever do that."
Screaming insults, Grandmother, with her bare hand, shoved over a kettle of soup to slop and hiss down through the stove. She went to her room and slammed the door. Frances heard her cursing in her room and objects thrown against the walls. She didn't come out again all evening. Queen Mother cleaned up the soup and fed the old people. She got her few things together in a basket and put on her old sweater and stocking cap. She looked for Francis, but couldn't find him. She was in the wagon when she saw the boy sitting in the corner of the porch. He watched her climb down heavily and come back to him.
"Possum, I'm going now. I won't be back here. Saronia at the feed store, she'll call your mama for me. You need me before your mama get here. You come to my house."
He twisted away from the touch on his cheek. Mr. Bailey clucked to the mules. Francis watched the wagon lantern move away. He had watched it before, with a sad and empty feeling, since he understood that Queen Mother betrayed him. Now he didn't care. He was glad. A feeble kerosene wagon light fading down the road. It was nothing to the moon. He wondered how it feels to kill a mule. Marion Dollarhide Vogt did not come when Queen Mother Bailey called her. She came 2 weeks later after a call from the sheriff in St. Charles. She arrived in mid-afternoon, driving herself in a pre-war Packard. She wore gloves and a hat. A deputy sheriff met her at the end of the lane and stooped to the car window.
"Mrs. Vogt, your mother called our office around noon, saying something about the help stealing. When I come out here, you'll excuse me, but she was talking out of her head, and it looked like things wasn't tended to. Sheriff thought he ought to get hold of y'all first, if you understand me. Mr. Vogt being before the public and all."
Marion understood him. Mr. Vogt was Commissioner of Public Works in St. Louis now, and was not in the party's best graces.
"To my knowledge, nobody else has saw the place," the deputy said.
Marion found her mother asleep. 2 of the old people were still sitting at the table waiting for lunch. 1 woman was out in the backyard in her slip. Marion telephoned her husband.
"How often do they inspect these places? They must not have seen anything. I don't know if any relatives have complained. I don't think these people have any relatives. No, no, you stay away. I need some Negroes. Get me some Negroes. And Dr. Waters. I'll take care of it.
The doctor, with an orderly in white, arrived in 45 minutes, followed by a panel truck bringing Marion's maid and 5 other domestics. Marion, the doctor, and the orderly were in grandmother's room when Francis came home from school. Francis could hear his grandmother cursing. When they rolled her out in one of the nursing home wheelchairs, she was glassy-eyed, and a piece of cotton was taped to her arm. Her face looked sunken and strange without her teeth. Marion's arm was bandaged, too. She had been bitten. Grandmother rode away in the doctor's car, sitting in the back seat with the orderly. Francis watched her go. He started to wave, but let his hand fall back to his side. Marion's cleaning crew scrubbed and aired the house, did a tremendous wash, and bathed the old people. Marion worked alongside them and supervised a sketchy meal. She spoke to Francis only to ask where things were. Then she sent the crew away and called the county authorities. Mrs. Dollarhide had suffered a stroke, she explained. It was dark when the welfare workers came for the patients in a school bus. Francis thought they would take him, too. He was not discussed. Only Marion and Francis remained at the house. She sat at the dining room table with her head in her hands. He went outside and climbed a crabapple tree. Finally, Marion called him. She had packed a small suitcase with his clothes. "You'll have to come with me," she said, walking to the car. "Get in. Don't put your feet on the seat." They drove away in the Packard and left the empty wheelchair standing in the yard. There was no scandal. The county authorities said it was sure a shame about Mrs. Dollarhide. She sure kept things nice. The Vogts remained untarnished. Grandmother was confined to a private nerve sanatorium. It would be 14 years before Francis went home to her again. "Francis, here are your stepsisters and stepbrother," his mother said. They were in the Vogt's library. Ned Vogt was 12, Victoria 13, and Margaret 9. Ned and Victoria looked at each other. Margaret looked at the floor. Francis was given a room at the top of the servants' stairs. Since the disastrous election of 1944, the Vogts no longer employed an upstairs maid. He was enrolled in Potter Gerard Elementary School, within walking distance of the house, and far from the Episcopal private school the other children attended. The Vogt children ignored him as much as possible during the first few days, but at the end of the first week, Ned and Victoria came up the servants' stairs to call. Francis heard them whispering for minutes before the knob turned on his door. When they found it bolted, they didn't knock. Ned said, "Open this door." Francis opened it. They did not speak to him again while they looked through his clothes in the wardrobe. Ned Vogt opened a drawer in the small dressing table and picked up the things he found with 2 fingers. Birthday handkerchiefs with FD embroidered on them. A capo for a guitar. A bright beetle in a pill bottle. A copy of Baseball Joe in the World Series, which had once been wet. And a get-well card signed, "Your classmate Sarah Hughes." "What's this?" Ned asked. "A capo." "What's it for?" "A guitar." "Do you have a guitar?"
"No."
"What do you have it for?" Victoria asked.
"My father used it."
"I can't understand you. What did you say? Make him say it again, Ned." "He said it belonged to his father." Ned blew his nose on one of the handkerchiefs and dropped it back in the drawer. "They came for the ponies today," Victoria said. She sat on the narrow bed. Ned joined her, his back against the wall, his feet on the quilt. "No more ponies," Ned said. "No more lake house for the summer. You know why? Speak up, you little bastard."
"Father is sick a lot and doesn't make as much money,"
Victoria said. Some days he doesn't go to the office at all. Know why he's sick, you little bastard? Ned asked. Talk where I can understand you.
Grandmother said he's a drunk. Understand that all right?
He's sick because of your ugly face, Ned said.
That's why people didn't vote for him, too, Victoria said.
Get out, Francis said.
When he turned to open the door, Ned kicked him in the back. Francis tried to reach his kidney with both hands, which saved his fingers as Ned kicked him in the stomach.
Oh, Ned, Victoria said. Oh, Ned.
Ned grabbed Francis by the ears and held him close to the mirror over the dressing table.
That's why he's sick.
Ned slammed his face into the mirror.
That's why he's sick.
Slam.
That's why he's sick. Slam.
The mirror was smeared with blood and mucus. Ned let him go, and he sat on the floor. Victoria looked at him, her eyes wide, holding her lower lip between her teeth. They left him there. His face was wet with blood and spit. His eyes watered from the pain, but he did not cry. Chapter 28 Rain in Chicago drums through the night on the canopy over the open grave of Freddie Lowndes. Thunder jars Will Graham's pounding head as he weaves from the table to a bed where dreams coil beneath the pillow. The old house above St. Charles, shouldering the wind, repeats its long sigh over the hiss of rain against the windows and the bump of thunder. The stairs are creaking in the dark. Mr. Dollarhide is coming down them, his kimono whispering over the treads, his eyes wide with recent sleep. His hair is wet and neatly combed. He has brushed his nails. He moves smoothly and slowly, carrying his concentration like a brimming cup. Film beside his projector. Two subjects. Other reels are piled in the wastebasket for burning. Two left, chosen from the dozens of home movies he has copied at the plant and brought home to audition. Comfortable in his reclining chair, with a tray of cheese and fruit beside him, Dollarhide settles in to watch. The first film is a picnic from the 4th of July weekend. A handsome family, three children, the father bull-necked, dipping into the pickle jar with his thick fingers, and the mother. The best view of her is in the softball game with the neighbor's children, only about 15 seconds of her. She takes a lead off second base, faces the pitcher and the plate, feet apart, ready to dash either way, her breasts swaying beneath her pullover as she leans forward from the waist. An annoying interruption as a child swings a bat. The woman again, walking back to tag up. She puts one foot on the boat cushion they use for a base and stands hip-shot, the thigh muscle tightening in her locked leg. Over and over, Dollarhide watches the frames of the woman, foot on the base, pelvis tilts, thigh muscle tightens under the cut-off jeans. He freezes the last frame. The woman and her children. They are dirty and tired. They hug, and a dog wags among their legs. A terrific crash of thunder clinks the cut crystal in Grandmother's tall cabinet. Dollarhide reaches for a pair. The second film is in several segments. The title, The New House, is spelled out in pennies on a shirt cardboard above a broken piggy bank. It opens with Father pulling up the for sale sign in the yard. He holds it up and faces the camera with an embarrassed grin. His pockets are turned out. An unsteady, long shot of Mother and three children on the front steps. It is a handsome house, a cut to the swimming pool. A child, sleek-headed and small, pads around to the diving board, leaving wet footprints on the tile. Heads bob in the water. A small dog paddles toward a daughter, his ears back, chin high, and the whites of his eyes showing. Mother in the water holds to the ladder and looks up at the camera.
Her curly black hair has the gloss of pelt, her bosom swelling, shining wet above her suit, her legs wavy below the surface, scissoring. Night. A badly exposed shot across the pool to the lighted house, the lights reflected in the water. Indoors and family fun. Boxes everywhere and packing materials. An old trunk not yet stored in the attic. A small daughter is trying on grandmother's clothes. She has on a big garden party hat. Father is on the sofa. He looks a little drunk. Now father must have the camera. It is not quite level. Mother is at the mirror in the hat. The children jostle around her, the boys laughing and plucking at the old finery. The girl watches her mother coolly, appraising herself in time to come. A close-up. Mother turns and strikes a pose for the camera with an arch smile, her hand at the back of her neck. She's quite lovely. There is a cameo at her throat. Dollarhide freezes the frame. He backs up the film. Again and again she turns from the mirror and smiles. Absently, Dollarhide picks up the film of the softball game and drops it in the wastebasket. He takes the reel from the projector and looks at the gateway label on the box. Bob Sherman, Star Route 7, Box 603, Tulsa, Oklahoma. An easy drive, too. Dollarhide holds the film in his palm and covers it with his other hand as though it were a small living thing that might struggle to escape. It seems to jump against his palm like a cricket. He remembers the jerkiness, the haste at the Leeds house when the lights came on. He had to deal with Mr. Leeds before turning on his movie lights. This time, he wants a smoother progression. It would be wonderful to crawl in between the sleepers with the camera going and snuggle up a little while. Then he could strike in the dark and sit up between them happily getting wet. He can do that with infrared film, and he knows where to get some. The projector is still on. Dollarhide sits holding the film between his hands, while on the bright blank screen, other images move for him to the long sigh of the wind. There is no sense of vengeance in him, only love and thoughts of the glory to come. Hearts becoming faint and fast, like footsteps fleeing into silence. Him rampant, him rampant. Filled with love, the Shermans opening to him. The past does not occur to him at all, only the glory to come. He does not think of his mother's house. In fact, his conscious memories of that time are remarkably few and indistinct. Sometime in his 20s, Dollarhide's memories of his mother's house sank out of sight, leaving a slick on the surface of his mind. He knew that he had lived there only a month. He did not recall that he was sent away at the age of 9 for hanging Victoria's cat. One of the few images he retained was the house itself, lighted, viewed from the street in winter twilight as he passed it going from Potter Gerard Elementary School to the house where he was boarded a mile away. He could remember the smell of the Vogt library, like a piano just opened, when his mother received him there to give him holiday things. He did not remember the faces at the upstairs windows as he walked away, down the frozen sidewalk, the practical gifts burning hateful under his arm, hurrying home to a place inside his head that was quite different from St. Louis. At the age of 11, his fantasy life was active and intense, and when the pressure of his love grew too great, he relieved it. He preyed on pets, carefully, with a cool eye to consequence. They were so tame that it was easy. The authorities never linked him with the sad little bloodstains soaked into the dirt floors of garages. At 42, he did not remember that. Nor did he ever think about the people in his mother's house, his mother, stepsisters, or stepbrother. Sometimes he saw them in his sleep, in the brilliant fragments of a fever dream, altered and tall, faces and bodies in bright parrot colors, they poised over him in a mantis stance. When he chose to reflect, which was seldom, he had many satisfactory memories. They were of his military service. Caught at 17, entering the window of a woman's house, for a purpose never established, he was given the choice of enlisting in the army or facing criminal charges. He took the army. After basic training, he was sent to specialist school in darkroom operation and shipped to San Antonio, where he worked on Medical Corps training films at Brooke Army Hospital. Surgeons at Brooke took an interest in him and decided to improve his face. They performed a Z-plasty on his nose, using ear cartilage to lengthen the columella, and repaired his lip with an interesting Abbe flap procedure that drew an audience of doctors to the operating theater. The surgeons were proud of the result. Dollarhide declined the mirror and looked out the window. Records at the film library show Dollarhide checked out many films, mainly on trauma, and kept them overnight. He re-enlisted in 1958, and in his second hitch, he found Hong Kong. Stationed at Seoul, Korea, developing film from the tiny spotter planes the Army floated over the 38th parallel in the late 1950s, he was able to go to Hong Kong twice on leave. Hong Kong and Kowloon could satisfy any appetite in 1959. Grandmother was released from the sanatorium in 1961 in a vague Thorazine piece. Dollarhide asked for and received a hardship discharge 2 months before his scheduled separation date and went home to take care of her. It was a curiously peaceful time for him as well. With his new job at Gateway, Dollarhide could hire a woman to stay with Grandmother in the daytime. At night, they sat in the parlor together, not speaking. The tick of the old clock and its chimes were all that broke the silence. He saw his mother once, at Grandmother's funeral in 1970. He looked through her, past her, with his yellow eyes so startlingly like her own. She might have been a stranger. His appearance surprised his mother. He was deep-chested and sleek, with her fine coloring and a neat mustache, which she suspected was hair transplanted from his head. She called him once in the next week and heard the receiver slowly replaced. For 9 years after Grandmother's death, Dollarhide was untroubled, and he troubled no one. His forehead was as smooth as a seed. He knew that he was waiting. For what? He didn't know. One small event, which occurs to everyone, told the seed in his skull it was time. Standing by a north window, examining some film, he noticed aging in his hands. It was as though his hands holding the film had suddenly appeared before him, and he saw in that good north light that the skin had slackened over the bones and tendons, and his hands were creased in diamonds as small as lizard scales. As he turned them in the light, an intense odor of cabbage and stewed tomatoes washed over him. He shivered, though the room was warm. That evening, he worked out harder than usual. A full-length mirror was mounted on the wall of Dollarhide's attic gym, beside his barbells and weight bench. It was the only mirror hanging in his house, and he could admire his body in it comfortably, because he always worked out in a mask. He examined himself carefully while his muscles were pumped up. At 40, he could have competed successfully in regional bodybuilding competition. He was not satisfied. Within the week, he came upon the Blake painting. It seized him instantly. He saw it in a large full-color photograph in Time magazine, illustrating a report on the Blake retrospective at the Tate Museum in London. The Brooklyn Museum had sent the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun to London for the show. Time's critic said, "Few demonic images in Western art radiate such a nightmarish charge of sexual energy."
Dollarhide didn't have to read the text to find that out.
He carried the picture with him for days, photographed and enlarged it in the darkroom late at night. He was agitated much of the time. He posted the painting beside his mirror in the weight room and stared at it while he pumped. He could sleep only when he had worked out to exhaustion and watched his medical films to aid him in sexual relief. He had known since the age of 9 that essentially he was alone, and that he would always be alone, a conclusion more common to the 40s. Now, in his 40s, he was seized by a fantasy life with the brilliance and freshness and immediacy of childhood. It took him a step beyond alone. At a time when other men first see and fear their isolation, Dollarhide's became understandable to him. He was alone because he was unique. With the fervor of conversion, he saw that if he worked at it, if he followed the true urges he had kept down for so long, cultivated them as the inspirations they truly were, he could become. The dragon's face is not visible in the painting, but increasingly Dollarhide came to know how it looked. Watching his medical films in the parlor, pumped up from lifting, he stretched his jaw wide to hold in grandmother's teeth. They did not fit his distorted gums, and his jaw cramped quickly. He worked on his jaw in private moments, biting on a hard rubber block until the muscles stood out in his cheeks like walnuts. In the fall of 1979, Francis Dollarhide withdrew part of his considerable savings and took a 3-month leave of absence from Gateway. He went to Hong Kong, and he took with him his grandmother's teeth. When he returned, red-haired Eileen and his other fellow workers agreed that the vacation had done him good. He was calm. They hardly noticed that he never used the employees' locker room or shower anymore. He had never done that often anyway. His grandmother's teeth were back in the glass beside her bed. His own new ones were locked in his desk upstairs. If Eileen could have seen him before his mirror, teeth in place, new tattoo, brilliant in the harsh gym light, she would have screamed once. There was time now. He did not have to hurry now. He had forever. It was 5 months before he selected the Jacobies. The Jacobies were the first to help him, the first to lift him into the glory of his becoming. The Jacobies were better than anything he ever knew, until the Leedses. And now, as he grew in strength and glory, there were the Shermans to come, and the new intimacy of infrared. Most promising.
Chapter 29.
Francis Dollarhide had to leave his own territory at Gateway Film Processing to get what he needed. Dollarhide was production chief of Gateway's largest division, home movie processing. But there were 4 other divisions. The recessions of the 1970s cut deeply into home movie making, and there was increasing competition from home video recorders. Gateway had to diversify. The company added departments which transferred film to videotape, printed aerial survey maps, and offered custom services to small-format commercial filmmakers. In 1979, a plum fell to Gateway. The company contracted jointly with the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to develop and test new emulsions for infrared photography. The Department of Energy wanted sensitive infrared film for its heat conservation studies. Defense wanted it for night reconnaissance. Gateway bought a small company next door, Bader Chemical, in late 1979, and set up the project there. Dollarhide walked across to Bader on his lunch hour, under a scrubbed blue sky, carefully avoiding the reflecting puddles on the asphalt. Lowndes' death had put him in an excellent humor. Everyone at Bader seemed to be out for lunch. He found the door he wanted at the end of a labyrinth of halls. The sign beside the door said, "Infrared sensitive materials in use. No safe lights. No smoking. No hot beverages." The red light was on above the sign. Dollarhide pushed a button, and in a moment the light turned green. He entered the light trap and rapped on the inner door. "Come." A woman's voice. Cool, absolute darkness. The gurgle of water. The familiar smell of D-76 developer, and a trace of perfume. "I'm Francis Dollarhide. I came about the dryer." "Oh, good. Excuse me. My mouth's full. I was just finishing lunch." He heard papers wadded and dropped in a wastebasket. "Actually, Ferguson wanted the dryer," said the voice in the dark. "He's on vacation, but I know where it goes. You have one over at Gateway?"
"I have two. One is larger. He didn't say how much room he has."
Dollarhide had seen a memo about the dryer problem weeks ago. "I'll show you if you don't mind a short wait."
"All right."
"Put your back against the door." Her voice took on a touch of the lecturer's practice tone. "Come forward 3 steps until you feel the tile under your feet, and there'll be a stool just to your left."
He found it.
He was closer to her now. He could hear the rustle of her lab apron.
"Thanks for coming down," she said.
Her voice was clear, with a faint ring of iron in it. "You're head of processing over in the big building, right?"
"Uh-huh."
"The same Mr. D who sends the rockets when the requisitions are filed wrong?"
"The very one."
"I'm Reba McLean. Hope there's nothing wrong over here."
"Not my project anymore.
I just planned the darkroom construction when we bought this place. I haven't been over here in 6 months." A long speech for him. Easier in the dark. "Just a minute more, and we'll get you some light. Do you need a tape measure?"
"I have one."
Dollarhide found it rather pleasant, talking to the woman in the dark. He heard the rattle of a purse being rummaged, the click of a compact. He was sorry when the timer rang. "There we go. I'll put this stuff in the black hole," she said. He felt a breath of cold air, heard a cabinet close on rubber seals, and the hiss of a vacuum lock. A puff of air and fragrance touched him as she passed. Dollarhide pressed his knuckle under his nose, put on his thoughtful expression, and waited for the light. The lights came on. She stood by the door, smiling in his approximate direction. Her eyes made small, random movements behind the closed lids. He saw her white cane propped in the corner. He took his hand away from his face and smiled.
"Do you think I could have a plum?" he said.
There were several on the counter where she had been sitting.
"Sure, they're really good."
Reba McLean was about 30, with a handsome prairie face, shaped by good bones and resolution. She had a small star-shaped scar on the bridge of her nose. Her hair was a mixture of wheat and red gold, cut in a page boy that looked slightly out of date, and her face and hands were pleasantly freckled by the sun. Against the tile and stainless steel of the darkroom, she was as bright as fall. He was free to look at her. His gaze could move over her as freely as the air. She had no way to parry eyes. Dollarhide often felt warm spots, stinging spots on his skin when he talked to a woman. They moved over him to wherever he thought the woman was looking. Even when a woman looked away from him, he suspected that she saw his reflection. He was always aware of reflective surfaces, knew the angles of reflection as a pool shark knows the banks. His skin now was cool, hers was freckled, pearly on her throat and the insides of her wrists. "I'll show you the room where he wants to put it," she said. "We can get the measuring done." They measured.
"Now, I want to ask a favor."
Tellerhide said. Okay. I need some infrared movie film, hot film, sensitive up around 1,000 nanometers. You'll have to keep it in the freezer and put it back in the cold after you shoot. I know. Could you give me an idea of the conditions? Maybe I... shooting at maybe 8 feet with a pair of Rattan filters over the lights? It sounded too much like a surveillance rig. At the zoo, he said. In the world of darkness, they want to photograph the nocturnal animals. They must really be spooky if you can't use commercial infrared. Uh-huh. I'm sure we can fix you up. One thing, though. You know, a lot of our stuff is under the DD contract. Anything that goes out of here, you have to sign for. Right. When do you need it? About the 20th. No later. I don't have to tell you, the more sensitive it is, the meaner it is to handle. You get into coolers, dry ice, all that. They're screening some samples about 4 o'clock, if you want to look. You can pick the tamest emulsion that'll do what you want. I'll come. Reba McLean counted her plums after Dollarhide left. He had taken one. Strange man, Mr. Dollarhide. There had been no awkward pause of sympathy and concern in his voice when she turned on the lights. Maybe he already knew she was blind. Better yet, maybe he didn't give a damn. That would be refreshing. Chapter 30 In Chicago, Freddie Lowndes' funeral was underway. The National Tatler paid for the elaborate service, rushing the arrangements so that it could be held on Thursday, the day after his death. Then the pictures would be available for the Tatler edition, published Thursday night. The funeral was long in the chapel, and it was long at the graveside. A radio evangelist went on and on in fulsome eulogy. Graham rode the greasy swells of his hangover and tried to study the crowd. The hired choir at graveside gave full measure for the money, while the Tatler photographer's motor-driven cameras whizzed. Two TV crews were present with fixed cameras and creepy peepees. Police photographers with press credentials photographed the crowd. Graham recognized several plainclothes officers from Chicago Homicide. Theirs were the only faces that meant anything to him. And there was Wendy of Wendy City, Lowndes' girlfriend. She was seated beneath the canopy nearest the coffin. Graham hardly recognized her. Her blonde wig was drawn back in a bun, and she wore a black tailored suit. During the last hymn, she rose, went forward unsteadily, knelt, and laid her head on the casket, her arms outstretched in the pall of chrysanthemums as the strobe lights flashed. The crowd made little noise moving over the spongy grass to the cemetery gates. Graham walked beside Wendy. A crowd of the uninvited stared at them through the bars of the high iron fence. "Are you all right?" Graham asked. They stopped among the tombstones. Her eyes were dry, her gaze level. "Better than you," she said. "Got drunk, didn't you?" "Yep. Is somebody keeping an eye on you?"
"The precinct sent some people over. They've got plain clothes in the club. Lots of business now. More weirdos than usual."
"I'm sorry you had this. You did. I thought you were fine at the hospital. I admired that."
She nodded. "Freddie was a sport. He shouldn't have to go out that hard. Thanks for getting me in the room." She looked into the distance, blinking, thinking, eye shadow like stone dust on her lids. She faced Graham. "Look, the Tatler's giving me some money. You figured that, right? For an interview and the dive at the graveside. I don't think Freddie would mind."
"He'd have been mad if you passed it up."
"That's what I thought. They're jerks, but they pay. What it is, they tried to get me to say that I think you deliberately turned this freak onto Freddie, chumming with him in that picture. I didn't say it, If they print that I did say it, well, that's bullshit.
Graham said nothing as she scanned his face.
You didn't like him, maybe. It doesn't matter. But if you thought this could happen, you wouldn't have missed the shot at the ferry, right?
Yeah, Wendy. I'd have staked him out.
Do you have anything at all? I hear noise from these people, and that's about it.
We don't have much. A few things from the lab we're following up. It was a clean job, and he's lucky.
Are you?
What?
Lucky.
Off and on.
Freddy was never lucky. He told me he'd clean up on this. Big deals everywhere.
He probably would have, too.
Well, look, Graham, if you ever, you know, feel like a drink, I've got one.
Thanks.
But stay sober on the street.
Oh, yes. Two policemen cleared a path for Wendy through the crowd of curiosity seekers outside the gate. One of the gawkers wore a printed T-shirt reading, "The Tooth Fairy is a one-night stand." He whistled at Wendy. The woman beside him slapped his face. A big policeman squeezed into the 280ZX beside Wendy, and she pulled into the traffic. A second policeman followed in an unmarked car. Chicago smelled like a spent skyrocket in the hot afternoon. Graham was lonely, and he knew why. Funerals often make us want sex. It's one in the eye for death. The wind rattled the dry stalks of a funeral arrangement near his feet. For a hard second, he remembered palm fronds rustling in the sea wind. He wanted very much to go home, knowing that he would not, could not, until the dragon was dead.
Chapter 31. The projection room at Bader Chemical was small, five rows of folding chairs with an aisle in the middle. Dollarhide arrived late. He stood at the back with his arms folded while they screened gray cards, color cards, and cubes variously lighted, filmed on a variety of infrared emulsions. His presence disturbed Dandridge, the young man in charge. Dollarhide carried an air of authority at work. He was the recognized darkroom expert from the parent company next door, and he was known to be a perfectionist. Dandridge had not consulted him in months, a petty rivalry that had gone on since Gateway bought Bader Chemical. "Reba, give us the development dope on sample 8," Dandridge said. Reba McLean sat at the end of a row, a clipboard in her lap. Speaking in a clear voice, her fingers moving over the clipboard in the semi-darkness, she outlined the mechanics of the development, chemicals, temperature and time, and storage procedures before and after filming. Infrared-sensitive film must be handled in total darkness. She had done all the darkroom work, keeping the many samples straight by touch code and keeping a running record in the dark. It was easy to see her value to Bader. The screening ran through quitting time. Reba McLean kept her seat as the others were filing out. Dollarhide approached her carefully. He spoke to her at a distance while there were others in the room. He didn't want her to feel watched.
"I thought you hadn't made it," she said.
"I had a machine down. It made me late."
The lights were on. Her clean scalp glistened in the part of her hair as he stood over her.
"Did you get to see the 1000C sample?"
"I did."
"They said it looked all right. It's a lot easier to handle than the 1200 series. Think it'll do?"
"It will."
She had her purse with her and a light raincoat. He stood back when she came into the aisle behind her searching cane. She didn't seem to expect any help. He didn't offer any. Dandridge stuck his head back into the room.
"Reba, dear, Marcia had to fly. Can you manage?"
Spots of color appeared in her cheeks.
"I can manage very well, thank you, Danny."
"I'd drop you, love, but I'm late already. Say, Mr. Dollarhide, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, could you..."
"Danny, I have a ride home."
she held in her anger. The nuances of expression were denied her, so she kept her face relaxed. She couldn't control her color, though. Watching with his cold, yellow eyes, Dolarhyde understood her anger perfectly. He knew that Dandridge's limp sympathy felt like spit on her cheek.
"I'll take you," he said, rather late.
"No, but thank you." She had thought he might offer and had intended to accept. She wouldn't have anybody forced into it.
Damn Dandridge, damn his fumbling. She'd ride the damn bus, damn it.
She had the fare, and she knew the way, and she could go anywhere she fucking pleased. She stayed in the woman's room long enough for the others to leave the building. The janitor let her out. She followed the edge of a dividing strip across the parking lot